You know, I believe that the trajectory of our lives is in large part dependent on how we respond to injustice. Of course, we all experience injustice in different ways. Sometimes injustice comes into our lives through a specific person or a group of people. Sometimes we just experience circumstances in general that seem really, really unfair. But we all go through it. And that's just our lot in this life. Someday it's going to be different, and God's going to make it all right. But for now, we experience unfairness. And when we experience unfairness, we realize that that kind of injustice has an enormous power in our lives. And it can change us. And sometimes injustice turns us cold and bitter, and it hardens us. And sometimes that hardness persists, and it grows in our lives over the years. And at the end of our lives, it can leave us just as a shell of who we used to be. Cold, bitter, cynical. But it's also true that in a very mysterious way, sometimes we can come out on the other side of injustice in a place of greater peace and joy and contentment. And the circumstances may not be different, but somehow the response that we have to that injustice points us down one of those two roads. And we all desperately need resources to be able to respond in such a way that we pursue that peace and that contentment and that joy. And I think David's life helps us with that. If you're new with us this morning, we are teaching through the life of David this fall. And David is a really, really significant figure in the Bible. There was a lot written about David, a lot written by David in the Bible. It seems that God wanted to use his life in a really special way. God wanted to reveal certain truths to us. God wanted us to be transformed through his life. You know, the Bible is such an interesting book. It's so unique. When we think of religious texts, it has so many different types of writing or genres in it. And we have law, we have teaching, we have instruction in the Bible, but we also have a whole lot of history, narrative, story. And that apparently God wanted to teach us through story. And as we observe people's lives, real people's lives, he wanted to change us. And specifically, he wanted to change us through David. So David's life is really important. And so we're going to continue our series. Right now we're in 1 Samuel 21. We're going to read chapters 21 and 22. And that's going to be on page 244 of your house Bible. So we're going to read these two chapters, although we're going to paraphrase parts of them. And let me pray one more time before we read God's word. Lord, I do pray. I pray that you would reveal right now. We believe that you actively reveal to us. You change our hearts. You open them somehow. In a very mysterious way, you come down and you change us and you make us receptive and you teach us. And I pray that you would do that this morning. I pray that as we read about David's life, you would open our eyes to see things in our own lives that we need to surrender to you. And I pray that you would open our eyes to see you more clearly. And so God, as we read, please turn our hearts to be receptive to you, to see you more clearly. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, let me set up, before we start reading, let me set up where we're at. So Israel had asked for a king, and God had given them a king. He'd given them King Saul. Saul was their first king, although Saul turned out to be not a very good king. And so God promised that he was going to remove Saul and give the kingship to another person. That was going to be David. David was not king yet, though. He was serving underneath Saul. But Saul realized that David was increasing in power and in favor, and he became very, very jealous. And his jealousy drove him to madness, as we will see in these chapters. But he became increasingly fearful of David, jealous of him, and so he was turning to murder David, and he was intent on killing him. Now, there were a few times that he actually tried to kill David, and it was becoming more and more apparent that this is what was going to happen. David has a conversation with his friend Jonathan. Jonathan is Saul's son. And at first, Jonathan says, no, there's no way. My dad's not trying to kill you. But after an interaction with his father, he discovers that, yes, indeed, Saul is determined to kill David. So Jonathan tells David about this, and when he hears this from Jonathan, David must flee. And he just turns and runs, and as we'll see, he must flee very quickly. He doesn't gather anything, he doesn't turn back, he just runs. And so that's where we pick it up in chapter 21. So let's read it in verse 1. Then David came to Nob, to Ahimelech, the priest, and Ahimelech came to meet David, trembling, and said to him, "Why are you alone and no one with you?" And David said to Ahimelech the priest, "The king has charged me with a matter and said to me, 'Let no one know anything of the matter about which I send you and with which I have charged you. I have made an appointment with the young men for such and such a place.'" So David flees first to this city of Nob. And this is a city of priests. Evidently, this was a place where people came to worship. Perhaps the tabernacle was there, but regardless, people came to seek God in this place, and there were a whole bunch of priests that lived in Nob. I want to show you a map of where we're at, and this map shows several of the places where David bounces around. After he flees, he goes to different places around the country of Israel, and you'll see the numbers up there in the bubbles, and those are different places he lands in order. And so we actually pick it up at number 3 there. That's by the town of Gibeah. That's where Saul was at this time. And David realizes that he must get out of Gibeah, and he goes just a little south, to a very nearby town called Nob. This is the priestly town. And he comes to Nob, and he comes to the priest there, Ahimelech, and Ahimelech is wondering what's going on. This seems like a strange situation. David's there alone. David doesn't have anything. David bends the truth a little bit, and says he's on a special secret mission. And then he asks for some provisions. And so he asks for food, and he asks for weaponry. And Ahimelech gives those things to him. And so he's given some bread. Actually, Jesus mentions this instance later on in the Gospels. But he's given bread, and later he's given the sword of Goliath, whom David had killed earlier. So we just see that David is fleeing and he has nothing. He had to run very quickly. And so he goes to this nearby town of Nob and he gets a few things. He's got a few people with him and he continues on. We should read verse 7 though also. This is important. Now a certain man of the servants of Saul was there that day, detained before the Lord. His name was Doeg the Edomite, the chief of Saul's herdsmen. So there was the servant of Saul. He had an important position in Saul's kingdom. He was there, and he observes what goes on between David and Ahimelech. David recognizes, though, that he can't stay here, and Saul is going to find him, and so he must continue to run. And so we can pick it up in verse 10. And David rose and fled that day from Saul and went to Achish, the king of Gath. And so we can look at on our map. This time he goes clear to the west, outside the borders of Israel, to Philistia, where the Philistines lived. So you see number 5 up there on the map, and there's Gath. Verse 11, and the servants of Achish said to him, "Is not this David the king of the land? Did they not sing to one another of him in dances? Saul has struck down his thousands, and David his 10,000s." And David took these words to heart and was much afraid of Achish the king of Gath. So he changed his behavior before them and pretended to be insane in their hands and made marks on the doors of the gate and let his spittle run down his beard. And Achish said to his servants, "Behold, you see that the man is mad. Why then have you brought him to me? Do I lack bad men that you have brought this fellow to behave as a madman in my presence? Shall this fellow come into my house?" So David flees to Philistia, to Gath. And we don't know why he went there. It seems like he felt like he needed to get out of the country. And so he goes to this place that was likely dangerous. He wasn't sure how they were going to receive him. This was a foreign nation, and they had been actually at war, of course, with the Philistines. He had killed Goliath earlier. He'd been at war with the Philistines in previous years, but he felt like he might be able to find refuge here. But, and it's not really clear here, but it seems like their response to him demonstrated that they were not going to receive him favorably. And so he was fearful. He said, they're going to kill me here. And so he quickly came up with a plan, and he pretended like he was crazy. And he let the spit run down his beard, and he made marks on the door. And the king of Gath said, okay, this guy's crazy. Just get him out of here. And so his plan worked, and he was released, and he ran again. Verse 1 of chapter 22, David departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. And when his brothers and all his father's house heard it, they went down there to him. So he comes back east, and you'll see just a little to the east, number 6 up there on the map is where he's at. He's hiding in this cave. And so he's back in the center of Judah or Israel. Verse 2, and everyone who was in distress and everyone who was in debt and everyone who was bitter in soul gathered to him, and he became commander over them, and there were with him about 400 men. So what happens is all these outcasts start to gather around him, and he builds this little army of 400 people. Also, his family comes. You'll see his hometown of Bethlehem is a little to the east there. Adullam is in between Bethlehem and Gath. And so his family came to join him. They were probably fearful also that Saul would come for them. And so David gathers this little band of people, but he knows that he can't remain there either. Verse 3, and David went from there to Mizpah of Moab. And he said to the king of Moab, please let my father and my mother stay with you till I know what God will do for me. And he left them with the king of Moab, and they stayed with him all that time that David was in the stronghold. Then the prophet Gad said to David, do not remain in the stronghold, depart and go into the land of Judah. So David departed and went into the forest of Hereth. So from the cave, he goes further east across the Dead Sea over to Moab, another foreign nation. And he drops off his parents there. He assumes that they're not going to be safe in Israel, and they're not going to be safe running around in the wilderness with them. So he entrusts them to this king of Moab. So again, he tries to utilize a foreign nation. After that, though, the prophet, God communicates through this prophet Gad and says, no, actually go back. And so he goes back into the middle of Israel there in the forest of Hereth. And that's where he remains for a while. Now, in verse 6, we change scenes, and we go from David back to Saul, and we see what Saul's thinking at this point. Verse 6, now Saul heard that David was discovered, and the men who were with him. Saul was sitting at Gibeah under the tamarisk tree on the height with his spear in his hand, and all his servants were standing about him. And Saul said to his servants who stood about him, hear now, people of Benjamin, will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards? Will he make you all commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds, that all of you have conspired against me? No one discloses to me when my son makes a covenant with the son of Jesse. None of you is sorry for me or discloses to me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as this day. Then answered Doeg, the Edomite, who stood by the servants of Saul, I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob, to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, and he inquired of the Lord for him and gave him provisions and gave him the sword of Goliath, the Philistine. So Saul, we see where he's getting to, and he's just becoming more and more paranoid and crazy, and he believes that everybody is conspiring against him, even his own son. And so he's just lamenting here, and then Doeg, who was at Nob, speaks up. Doeg the Edomite, so he's a foreigner. And he speaks up and he says, well, I saw something. I saw David come to Nob, and Ahimelech gave him some things and inquired of the Lord for him. So Saul ends up summoning Ahimelech, and he questions him about this, and Ahimelech, rightfully so, says, well, I didn't know what was going on, and he was completely innocent. He was. But Saul refuses to listen. And he says, Ahimelech, you must die. And so he kills Ahimelech. And not only him, but he kills 85 priests from Nob, this priestly city. He doesn't kill him. Actually, Doeg does. He tells his servants to kill Ahimelech. They all refuse because they don't really respect him. Then he says, well, how about you, Doeg? You kill him. And so he does, and then they slaughter 85 priests, and then they go to the town of Nob, and they slaughter everybody. And they just destroy the entire city there. And it's kind of ironic. Before, Saul had gotten in trouble because he had refused to destroy completely the Amalekites. But here, he destroys completely this priestly city. within Israel. And this was really the height of his madness that he was willing to do this. Verse 20, but one of the sons of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped and fled after David. And Abiathar told David that Saul had killed the priests of the Lord. And David said to Abiathar, I knew on that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul, I have occasioned the death of all the persons of your father's house. Stay with me, do not be afraid, for he who seeks my life seeks your life. With me you shall be in safe keeping. So that's our passage. That's the point in David's life that we're at. He is on the run and he is bouncing from place to place, and these are the events that happen. Now we can try to imagine what's going on inside of David at this point. This is an incredible low point in his life. Okay, obviously he has to flee. He has to flee very quickly and he has to leave everything that he knows. He has to leave his home. He leaves his best friend, Jonathan. He leaves his wife and he flees. He had been promised before that he would be given the kingdom, but it wasn't happening, and Saul was out to kill him, and he didn't know what was going to happen. And he's just running for his life through the wilderness, and he's struggling probably with a lot of different things. And first he flees to the Philistines. Maybe there was something that pricked his conscience there, that he's turning to this foreign nation, really this enemy. But he does, and then he's forced to lie, to pretend to be crazy. And you wonder what was going on with him there after he had to do that. How did he feel about that act? And then he runs back east, and again goes to Moab, another foreign nation. And then he discovers that the town of Nob had just been slaughtered by Saul. And he felt, I think, a deep guilt and regret. That's what he mentions there. That he remembers that Doeg was there. And I think at that point, when he saw him there at Nob, he thought, at least in the back of his mind, he thought maybe Doeg would betray him, would turn him in there. And of course he did. And that occasioned the destruction of this entire city. And so David is at a very, very low point here. Of course, there were several low points in David's life. Later on, we'll read about the gross sin that he commits. Later on, we'll read about his adult children turning against him. But I think this was different. For one, it was the first real low point in his life. But also, those later examples, they were somewhat self-inflicted. And he made certain mistakes, and there was some amount of justice in what he went through later on. Here, it seems completely unjust. He had done nothing but serve Saul very well. God was with him. His character was outstanding. And this is what happens. And his life falls apart. And he feels incredible guilt. He's unsure about things. He's betrayed by his king, Saul, and by this man, Doeg. And this is a point that could likely destroy a person. This is where somebody could turn to that cold bitterness, where you could feel like, I've done everything well, and it all fell apart. And this is completely unfair. Okay, that naturally would be the response. That's what we would expect, that this kind of injustice would harden a man. But you know what? It doesn't harden David. And we see that. We see that in the events in the following chapters. And especially we see that in his poems. In his poems. David was a poet. I mentioned earlier there are lots of different types of genres or types of writings in the Bible. And there's history and there's law and there's instruction. But there's also poetry. And right in the middle of the Bible, we have this big book called Psalms. And it's this collection of 150 poems or songs that were written by different people. And apparently God wanted to speak to us through these psalms, these prayers, these songs. And there's something there that he has for us to be led into. There's 150 psalms. About half of them were written by David. Okay, he was a prolific songwriter. And out of those, about a dozen of them, we have little statements at the beginning of the psalm that tell us about the events that were happening when he wrote the psalm. And out of those dozen psalms where we know when they were written, actually three of them, most likely, were written during the events described in these two chapters that we read this morning. This, of course, was a very reflective time in David's life. Understandably so. And so he pours himself out in song. And we get to read those. And I'd like to read one of them this morning. And Psalm 34. So why don't you turn with me to Psalm 34. It's going to be on page 463. And you'll see the statement at the beginning describing when this happens of David when he changed his behavior before Abimelech so that he drove him out and he went away. So right after David acts like he's insane and he's driven out of Gath, he writes this psalm. And let's read the entire psalm together. I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise shall continually be in my mouth. My soul makes its boast in the Lord. Let the humble hear and be glad. Oh, magnify the Lord with me, and let us exalt his name together. I sought the Lord, and he answered me, and delivered me from all my fears. Those who look to him are radiant, and their faces shall never be ashamed. This poor man cried, and the Lord heard him, and saved him out of all his troubles. The angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him and delivers them. Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man who takes refuge in him. Oh, fear the Lord, you his saints, for those who fear him have no lack. The young lions suffer want and hunger, but those who seek the Lord lack no good thing. Come, O children, listen to me. I will teach you the fear of the Lord. What man is there who desires life and loves many days that he may see good? Keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking deceit. Turn away from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it. The eyes of the Lord are toward the righteous, and his ears toward their cry. The face of the Lord is against those who do evil, to cut off the memory of them from the earth. When the righteous cry for help, the Lord hears and delivers them out of all their troubles. The Lord is near to the brokenhearted and saves the crushed in spirit. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers him out of them all. He keeps all his bones. Not one of them is broken. Affliction will slay the wicked, and those who hate the righteous will be condemned. The Lord redeems the life of his servants. None of those who take refuge in him will be condemned. Now, as I said, there's a couple other psalms that are written in this period, Psalm 52 and Psalm 56, and we're not going to read those today, but I would encourage you to read them later. But what strikes me about each of these psalms, particularly Psalm 34, is its hopefulness, how promising it is, how content it seems like David is. It's a remarkable psalm, but you read it and you would not expect it to have been written during the events that it was written in. But it was. This psalm came out of this experience in David's life. And I think there's a reason for that. And I think this is one of the primary examples that we learn in David's life. It's really pretty amazing. We see the genuine relationship with God that David had. There's an authenticity there. There's a grittiness to his relationship. And it was a relationship with God that gave him a fresh perspective that allowed him to rise above his circumstances. And it's really amazing what we see as far as what was going on inside of him during these circumstances. In short, we see David's faith. We see that David had great and admirable faith. Now, in saying that he had great faith, I want to define that a little bit. And I want to define that biblically. What is biblical faith? How would the Bible describe faith? I want to do that by reading a verse. I think it's a key verse out of the New Testament. It's Hebrews 11:6. It's what it says. And without faith, It is impossible to please him, for whoever would draw near to God must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him. There's a lot in this verse that's interesting. First, it says that faith is what really pleases God. Faith is required to please God. Okay, in God's economy, faith is the currency. It's what he desires. It's what he wants to see in us. Elsewhere in the New Testament, in Galatians 5, it says the only thing that counts is faith expressing itself through love. So love is really the goal. We want to love, but faith is the root. It's the foundation. And so God wants faith to be cultivated in us. He wants to see faith grow in us. That's what he wants. He wants faith. That's what pleases him. But the verse goes on to at least indirectly define what faith is. And there are two components of faith here. The first one, of course, is simply to believe that God exists. That does seem pretty simple, pretty straightforward, but obviously that's very important, to believe that he exists. I came to this belief when I was in college. And prior to that, I had a kind of a fuzzy belief in something, in some kind of God. But it was not very conclusive. It was not a strong belief. It was not a well-defined belief. While I was in college, though, I began to be challenged. And questions were asked of me. And I began to ask questions. I'd have conversations. And I'd start to think about things. And I'd read. And pretty soon, I came to the conclusion that God is obviously there. And that all the evidence points that way. And that it's clear, and that I could be intellectually, rationally satisfied in that belief. I didn't have to leave my intellect at the door, but everything pointed to God being there, being real. If you're not to that point yet, I would love to talk to you. But that's obviously important, to believe that he exists, and that changes everything. That changes our perspective. That changes how we view the world. That changes what we call our worldview. We see things differently, and we arrange life differently. It's really, really important to believe that he exists. But that's the first step. And there's the second step, the second component that the verse mentions. Not only that we believe that he exists, but that he rewards those who seek him. So we believe not just that he exists, but that he does things, and that he's good, and that he brings good when we seek him. Really, the difference between this first step and the second step is the difference between what we call deism and authentic Christian faith. If you're not familiar with that term, a deist is somebody who believes in God, would acknowledge some kind of higher power, but doesn't really believe that God does anything. Okay, God initially, he wound up the clock. God initiated the mechanical workings of the universe, but he doesn't interfere with those mechanical workings of the universe, and he lets things go, and there's a distance there, and he's certainly not a God that can be known in a personal way. That's deism. I would say that the majority of people in our country, in this culture today, are deists. They may not describe themselves that way, but the majority of people here in our nation, I think, are practically deists. And they would acknowledge God. There are actually relatively few people that would emphatically say, no, there's no God. He doesn't exist. There's a handful of those, really. And in every poll that we see, year after year, generation after generation, we see that the vast majority of people believe that there is a God, because I think it's a kind of an intuitive thing. So they believe that God exists, but most of those people that believe God exists do not believe that he's active. They don't believe that he does things, that he rewards those who seek him. And even those of us that call ourselves Christians and have experienced some relationship with God, we very easily fall back into a practical deism. Where yes, we would acknowledge the existence of God, but we don't really have a personal connection with him, and we don't have expectations on him, and we don't really believe he answers, and we don't really believe he does things. He rewards, he brings good in this world. We just believe he's there. You know, I earlier this summer, my kids caught a tadpole. And they found this tadpole in this pond, and so we brought him home, created a little habitat for him. He's in this bin of water on our back patio. And so over the last couple months, we've been watching this tadpole. It's a slow process, but it's fascinating. And this tadpole is changing, and it's growing legs, the beginning of legs right now. And his face is becoming less tadpole-like and more frog-like. And it's just fascinating to observe this tadpole. So we like to watch him. But this tadpole doesn't give me a lot in terms of comfort and compassion. And there's not a real personal knowing of this tadpole. It's just fascinating. And so we like to look at it and watch it and keep it in this specimen jar and observe. And like so often, we keep God in this specimen jar. And he's pretty fascinating. And we believe he's there. Maybe we kind of think about him, who he might be, what he does. But there's not an active relationship with him and a back and forth communication and an expectation on what he does and doesn't do. We are practical deists, but David was not a deist. He was certainly not a deist. He believed God existed, but he believed God was his father and his friend. And there was a back and forth communication, and he wrestled with God, and he vented to God. And I can just imagine him going out in the wilderness and pacing back and forth and crying out to God, kind of like Jesus did. Jesus cried out to God with loud cries and tears. And there was an intimacy there that he had with God. We could look at some of Psalm 34, a few verses out of Psalm 34 again. It's what David says, I sought the Lord and he answered me. Okay, he answered. God did something. He delivered me from all my fears. God actively did something to pull David out of his fears here. He had such a relationship with a personal God that he was able to be delivered from his fears. Verse 6, this poor man cried, and the Lord heard him and saved him out of all his troubles. Again, there was a crying out to God, and then God answered, and God saved. Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man who takes refuge in him. He could take refuge in him. He knew God in such a personal way that there was a safety there. There's a peace and a contentment. The eyes of the Lord are toward the righteous and his ears toward their cry. The Lord is near to the brokenhearted and saves the crushed in spirit. He could genuinely claim that God was near, that God was attentive. This is what we see in David. It's the difference between God being there and God being near. And David was experiencing God's nearness. He knew that God was near. He was not only there. And he knew that he was especially near in his brokenheartedness when he was crushed in spirit. Oftentimes we say that religion or that Christianity is not just a religion, it's a relationship. If you've heard that a lot of times, you can feel like it's maybe overly cliche, but it's true. That it is about relationship with a person. God's really, really there, and he's involved. It is about relationship. My hope, as we go through the life of David here, is that David would lead us from a practical deism to genuine relationship. That we could mimic him in a lot of ways. Because I think he had that genuine relationship that we all want. And so many of us, we get lost in this just sort of intellectual acknowledgement of God's existence. I know that I can. I get stuck in just believing that God's there. And not often enough, Do I really engage with God in the way that we see David engaging with God? But my hope is that he can lead us there, and that we can observe in his relationship with God something that we can grab onto as well. And we're going to introduce actually a little bit of a practical tool for that today. I mentioned earlier that David wrote all these psalms, and about a dozen of them he wrote, and we know when he wrote them. And we know what was going on in his life when he wrote them. Well, over the last few months, we have commissioned several of our musicians and our songwriters and our poets in our congregation here to write songs based on those psalms, those dozen psalms that we know when they were written. And so we've commissioned these songwriters to do that. And over the upcoming months, we're going to release basically an album of psalm songs, a song at a time, as we come to them in our teachings. And the first one is this morning. It's Psalm 34. And so Amber Constant and Steve Parker have written a song inspired by these events that we just read about in David's life and inspired by Psalm 34. And they're going to share it with us this morning. So Steve and Amber, why don't you come on up here, and we're going to listen to their version of Psalm 34.